Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham. Once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, someone I go way back with from the bands, I guess we'll go chronological order, Dirge, Day of Mourning, Coming Correct, Integrity, Slumlords, or maybe Slumlords then Integrity, Ilsa, En-Rain, Heat Waves. I'm definitely screwing up the order now. Most recently, though, of the bands Permanent Mistakes and En-Rain, who put out one of my favorite LPs from last year, Dominic Romeo is on the show today, aka Dom. Very excited for you to hear this one. Oh, also, he runs an incredible record label, too, A389 Records as well. But more on all of that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That's run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me. You can also find me on Twitter or Instagram at Left4Damian. There's also a Facebook page, a Instagram page, a TikTok page, and a YouTube page, all for this podcast. All those can be found at Turned Out of Punk on those platforms right there. If you want to support the show, tell all your friends about this podcast. Let them all know that there's this podcast and there's good episodes that you like hearing, and spread the word that way. You can also check out the band I play in. We are called Fucked Up. We have a tour coming up of the West Coast of the United States in the end of January, beginning of February, and we will be putting out tons of records as well. All information can be found at fuckedup.cc or at fuckedup on Instagram and Twitter, YouTube, fucked up social media platforms everywhere as well. And that is that. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, someone I've known for a very long time on the show today, Dominic Romeo, who is a hardcore legend at this point, putting out some incredible records on his label, having played in some unbelievable bands over the years. Oh, I forgot Pulling Teeth. How could I forget Pulling Teeth off the top of the show? Pulling Teeth as well. Dom is someone who is a lifer in this genre and someone who's always had like a really cool, unique perspective that I think the world's just kind of caught up to. You'll hear about it all in today's episode in terms of the stuff he listens to, and he's ahead of the curve on a lot of stuff over me, that's for sure. But you'll hear us talk about it in a second. As I said off the top of the show, En-Rain put out a fantastic LP last year, which you should all go and pick up on the Mighty Relapse record, The Way of All Flesh is Decay. And this is a super group with All At War people, Bloodlet people, Integrity people, and Dom's catalog stuff, and Misery Index and stuff. So check out this band, a fantastic album that is out now. And I won't ramble on anymore. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Dom on Turned Out a Punk. Dom, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You are someone that I've wanted to have on for like years at this point. I think you have, and I might have even told you this in person, but I think you have the most incredible journey in punk and hardcore. And, you know, I feel like there's shit that we're going to talk about today that you and me were maybe two of 12 people in the room for. So this is going to be a fun one.
Absolutely, I agree.
Well, I got to start off the way they all start off, which is, Dom, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
Wow. I mean, there's so many different tiers for me. I came from a metal background when I was a little kid. You know, I loved Van Halen and Kiss and AC/DC and all that stuff. And, you know, I think most people my age, I'm 46, going on 47. Thrash was kind of a gateway. I had gotten into Metallica and Anthrax, which kind of, you know, opened the door to SOD and to DRI and bands like that, which in turn opened the door to everything else that started, you know. It kind of like, you know, rolled off of that, and Sepultura and like all the Roadrunner bands. But for me, the pivotal point was seeing Madball at the El Macambo. I think it would have been 1995, and it was a free show upstairs. With Doggy Dog and Downset. Yeah. I don't know if you remember this one. But I didn't know anything about this band at all, right? My friend's just like, you got to check this out. You'll love these guys. And I was like, all right, cool. So I go see them. And my first takeaway is that the songs are really short. they're in your face, and it's just like this band is like, oh, I came from a metal world, so I wasn't used to, being that engaged with the scenario. And it was incredible. A second takeaway was everyone loved this guitar player that looked like just some French baker. He had like a little mustache, and everyone kept yelling his name between songs. I had no idea, I didn't know, right? I'm just like, why does everyone like this guy so much? You just tell him Sigma on every song. He's like, and it's like I had a lot to unpack when I went home that night. There was no internet, so I had to kind of do a lot of reverse legwork to figure that one out. But I'm glad I did.
Well, how many people were there, right? Because like 95 Madball, like I've heard of this show, but and I saw Madball at the Elmo, what, like 5 years later, 4 years later, they'd play there again. But like 95, that is like not very many people in Toronto, I think, knew who Madball were at that
No,
point.
I think maybe, I don't know, 50 is generous. It was, it was like a Monday night. It was free. And they were all like kind of touring on their first. Doggy Dog was on All Bro Kings, Downset was on Self-Titled, and Madball was on Set It Off. And it was like, they were starting from like they were building it from the ground up. And I was really fortunate to get to see that. That was a life changer for me. I just knew that's what I wanted to do after seeing that,
It feels like Toronto also, like for the longest time, was kind of like a wasteland for hardcore. Like hardcore, so many classic shows that there were like, yeah, less than 50 people at in Toronto. Like there was like such a small scene. And that, when I say Toronto, I mean like all of us in the kind of greater Toronto area coming in to make 50
Sure.
people at these shows.
Agreed. Yeah, so I was thinking about that today, actually. And you put it best. It was an absolute wasteland. I remember, like, after getting the bug and trying to find like-minded friends, other shows, and whatnot, it wasn't happening in Toronto at the time. We had to either travel to Windsor or Montreal just to see that kind of thing, where people like were kind of into those bands. Unless you were, the chokehold era had just passed at that point. It was kind of coming to an end, and there was really no place for that kind of hardcore in Toronto. It didn't really come around later until No Warning popped up and, kind of championed it and brought it back. So it was like a real gray area. And I got to give credit. There was a guy named Jay Sterling that was like a guy from London. He used to call him Warzone Jay because he always had that Warzone hoodie on all the time, 24/7. Only outfit I've ever seen this dude wear was a camo shorts and Warzone hoodie. And he was responsible during that era of like 96 to maybe 98 of like probably a lot of these shows you're talking about. He was the guy. He was the guy that was doing Club Shanghai, that was like Blood for Blood and Stigmata. I don't know if you remember that show. It was like a Tuesday, and it was before the Promise Ring was playing.
It was
Which was,
you, me,
yeah,
the Terror Twins. There were like so few of us
there's like
there.
five people there. But you go now and it was like, of course I was at that show. And I was like, you were in line at the Promise Ring show, dude.
Yeah, you were not inside.
You're
They
not
were
inside.
so pissed. I don't think I've seen Stigmata and Blood for Blood angrier than
Oh,
those
I mean, it
guys.
was a Tuesday matinee, right? So it was like the odds were kind of stacked against them. But wow, Jay did like all those shows at 360. I swear I saw All Out War for the first time, and Blood for Blood for the first time. Mushmouth had played, and it was a cool. He was instrumental in bringing a lot of that. I remember the one show that I wanted to be true so bad that wasn't, was Fury of Five. I remember me and the Terror Twins were hanging out outside just hoping they would show up, hoping that like something would happen. Like we stayed way longer than we should have, hoping that something would turn around, and it never did, because that show unfortunately didn't go down in the books. But yeah, he was instrumental. And then I kind of picked up the torch and started doing shows too, because I wanted to see those kind of bands. And 100 Demons at JCC was a real good one with Death Threat. Remember that one? And it's a lot of cool stuff. And like I said, by the time No Warning started being a band, things were in full swing. And that's kind of was my experience with that.
Yeah, I think there's like that kind of No Warning, Day of Mourning, I guess Where It Ends, The Swarm kind of was also like
Yeah.
around that time too. Like it felt like all that comes together, and I think it's like we've talked about this off air too, but like that post that Sick of It All, Strife, Trigger Happy, One King Down show in Toronto, like that to me felt like the closing of one chapter in Toronto punk and the beginning of sort of like the next era.
Absolutely. That show was epic. Everybody was at that show. Everybody wanted to see Sick of It All. They were like at the height of their powers, and people were curious. Victory was kind of popping off at the time. And not many of the bands had made it over at that point. I think that was Strife's first time. I might be wrong, but yeah, everyone was really stoked, and that was like Also, that also became a, with all those bands you mentioned, it became a point of congregation where like Windsor would roll out, Montreal would roll out, and like the shows were really, really great. Like it was always like awesome, you know? It was a fond memory.
I remember that's the first time I met you, I think, was in that pit just before Sick of It All played. We were
Probably.
we talked about integrity.
Yeah, sounds right. I always think it was in front of Who's Emma for some reason. That you're probably right.
Yeah, but by that point, see, it's funny because, like, I guess maybe Jay was doing shows, some of those shows earlier than I'm thinking, because Dirge was already like a real band. Like, you guys already were being played on like Loud. You guys had that ARA fight song, 95.
We did. Yeah, but you got, remember, Dirge didn't really come into the hardcore scene, you know, with all boxes checked. We kind of like, you know, immigrated over from the Roadrunner world. You know, we came from that whole Fear Factory, Machine Head, and then Madball adjacent, you know, was kind of like the gateway for us. But yeah, at the time, you know, we were doing a lot of shows. I mean, geez, I think about like when Dirge was starting, we were like in high school. And we used to, none of us drove. And we used to take all of our equipment on the subway. We used to literally take it from Malton, which is a suburb out by the airport. And we'd get a bunch of our friends with us. And we'd all like just, you know, daisy chain our guitar caps, the drums, and everything. We'd take it on the bus, take it off, get on the subway, take it off, go play the show, leave it at the club, and come get it the next day the same way and bring it back. Because none of us drove. But we wanted, there was just nothing more that we wanted to do than just play in the city and be a band that played, you know, that was. That was it. It was never about being the biggest or the best or the coolest, because we're none of those. But it was just about getting to do it, you know? And like we all had that hunger to do it, and it was, it made a lot of memories for sure.
Well, it was also that drive too, because you guys had CDs out when bands were struggling to put out tapes. You know, like you guys had a video, like, you know, you guys were doing it, and it seems like that's almost immediately after you go to this Madball show. Like, you're like, is it like, was Dirge going before you got into Madball?
The Dirge demo would have been like 94 going into 95. So that Madball show would have been around the time the CD had just come out or was about to come out. And, you know, we were totally new. We didn't know what we're doing, right? We had a place that we rehearsed called Rumblefish Studios, which was out in Etobicoke, which was like instrumental in helping us out. Dave, the owner, recorded us, barely charged us anything. You know, he really just wanted to see one of the bands in the space do something. So, you know, he helped us press the CDs. He was like a huge, huge, huge part in that. And from there, you know, I'd remiss if I didn't mention Noel, the infamous Toronto promoter, had a huge hand in making sure, you know, he'd help us out. We'd play a bunch of shows and just do a bunch of wild stuff. I remember the first shows in the US Dirge ever played were like in Huntington, West Virginia. It was a weekend in West Virginia and Virginia. And that was it. We just played these two weird redneck bars. And, I recently went on vacation with my kids to West Virginia. We went to like a snow tubing place over Christmas. I'm like, whoa, you know, I haven't been here since 1995. Like we played this weird redneck bar. There's like nobody there, but I totally remember because it was the first two shows. I remember Noel be like, "Oh, would you like to go to Huntington, West Virginia?" And like, you know, we're like, okay, you know, and
How did he
I
get
then.
these shows? Like, how the fuck is Noel booking shows in the
This wasn't
Virginia?
the hardcore world, right? So this was
Yeah.
pretty much if someone hits a promoter in another city and is like, hey, can you hook us up with a show? We'll play for what, for bar money, you know what I mean? Whatever. It was just bands that were trying to do things. We weren't really tapped into hardcore network at the time. So it was really just a trial by fire. We were really like, we'll show up anywhere that'll have us. We don't care. And, you know, finding five like-minded people that would do that and that were willing to like kind of throw their life away at the time and like throw their money away and just do it. It was huge. You know what I mean? I mean, it was just unreal. And then he finally figured it out because he got us into a show with Against All Hope in Buffalo around that time in Asbury Alley. It was a, I think it was this club. Still remember because it was like the first time I'd seen a real, like, you know, such a Madball show. It was the first time I figured out. I'm like, okay, we're misdirecting our energy here. This is kind of like, this is what I want. And some, I remember almost getting knocked out by some dude that was moshing super, super hard to Against All Hope, which is, you know, figure out
Kind
the
of
irony
weird.
there. Melodic band, but you know, it was just a thing, and we became friends with like Steve Titus and those dudes in Lockjaw, and like it just snowballed. I think back then, and this was before an internet time, you would have to make friends with people that had similar interests, and those friendships held more weight. You know, I mean, it meant a lot to know, you know, like John from Connecticut that also liked Integrity. That was like a dude in your network, you know. That was a dude you can hit up and would be like, actually, we did have a guy in Connecticut. His name was Earl. He would go by Earl, the Duke of Thrash. And he had a zine. And you know, he brought us out to Connecticut. And it was awesome. You know, it was just like that easy back then. You could send somebody a tape or a CD and be like, hey, we'll play for a place to sleep on your floor. You know what I mean? We just want to come out and do it. And that's how it all kind of started.
Well, and that's the thing. Once you get tapped into that network and you kind of see it, it's the most incredible thing in the world because people aren't motivated by money. It's like one of the few places in the world where people aren't motivated by money.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's funny too when you think back to Toronto, because like obviously the walls break down eventually and we become one big scene. But even though there's only like 50 people at most in some of these rooms, it was all so divided
Oh,
back then.
you couldn't say it better. It was absolutely, we weren't made welcome at all. You know, we were like some nerds from the suburbs. Nobody wanted anything to do with us. And but they were also like, you know, like Wizard of Oz. They were like the big man behind the curtain, because I mean the little guy behind the curtain, because there wasn't really anything to protect. You know, there wasn't much of a scene to, like, you know, they can huff and puff that like you weren't here for, like, know, why or some shit. But like, it's like, yeah, so what? You know what I mean? It's like, you know, I always had a rule about music where it's like you didn't have to be there. You can discover stuff at your own pace. I always take that into consideration with every band I've ever done. It's never meant to be a band that's going to pop off at the moment and be this huge thing. It's always something where it's like, oh yeah, I wonder what that guy did after that. And you check it out, and you're like, well, that's cool. You know, I discovered why way after. I wasn't around for any of that stuff. I would never pretend to be either, you know. But there's just a lot of, like, you know, hate using the word, but it's like just real pompous, like posturing about like dictating who's allowed to participate and be this and that. We were just never like that, you know. We just wanted everybody to have a good time. If you like music, you're my friend. You know what I mean? I mean, that's how simple it was back then. Now I'd be a little more, I'd scrutinize it a little bit more before I
Yeah.
decided. But back then, you know, like I said, you like, I just visited a buddy of mine, this dude Manny, and we had met in Montreal when Dirge played in Montreal because he was wearing an Integrity shirt. This was like almost 30 years ago. No, I'm sorry, it was an Integrity hat. He had the hat that you can get the Victory catalog.
Yes.
And me and my daughter just visited him in New York. And I was explaining to my daughter, we met just because this dude was wearing an Integrity hat, and that was it. And we're friends like 30 years later. You know, it's just like, it's an unbelievable thing.
And it's also funny because Integrity, and now it seems so weird to say this, but that was the height of them being unfashionable.
Oh, absolutely.
Like no one liked Integrity then. And so we were like a cult unto ourselves. Like they would like talk about Integrity. I remember you trying to bring them to
Oh, yeah.
Toronto and like, you know, but it was just like there were so few of us. So yeah, like anytime you saw someone with an Integrity thing on, you'd be like, yo,
I want to be
let's
friends with that
talk.
guy. Yeah,
Yes.
absolutely. And you know, their whole catalog was kind of enshrouded in mystery. There's no internet. So other than the Victory records, I didn't even know Those Who Fear Tomorrow existed until, I don't know, 97, until Humanity came out, right? Because I used to trade VHS tapes with Warzone J. And you know, Integrity set would be mostly these songs I didn't know. And I was like, what the fuck, dude? Like, what are these songs? You know, and it took a lot of legwork to figure that out. I was at a show and I saw in the distro they had that "And Those Who Still Fear Tomorrow" reissue. And I was like, Jesus Christ. I'm like, this is incredible. You know what I mean? This is like a whole other world. I even remember Dave Mourning, the band that came after Dirge, recorded in Cleveland. We went to Mars to do our record solely on the strength and wings of loving Integrity and, like, you know, just Ringworm at the time, you know, like just being obsessed with that world and having so little to go off of. And I was hoping to go into those record stores, like Chris of Shattered Records was one, I think, and Warped was another one. Forgive me, it's been many years. I might be getting the name wrong. But just being able to find like the Comp for Atonement that had an Integrity song and State of Conviction song on it, and Rape Whistle was on it. Just shit you wouldn't see anywhere else except in Cleveland. Oh man, that was like a utopia. You know, I was like
It
all about it.
was, and it was like such like and it's so cool. Like that's what I think is so amazing is that you've put together this kind of scene of all these bands that you liked, and like, you know, through the label and just through being in some of these bands and working with these bands. But like at the time, this stuff was like beyond obscure.
Yeah.
Like Cold as Life was, you know, obviously a legendary band, but like you couldn't get any of that stuff.
No, Windsor was the closest ties. James Hardtime, that used to do Sounds of Revolution Records, I would go stay with him because Coles' life, I mean, Detroit was, you know, pretty much sister city to Windsor. And, you know, I got to see Coles' life a few times during that prime era, and it was magical, you know. It was funny. I used to sleep on James's couch, and we would listen to Sheer Terror, Just Can't Hate Enough, get pumped. And first thing, when Jeff G got out, and he was telling me, you know, that's his favorite record, and I'm like, man, you know what's funny is I used to listen to this record before coming to Detroit to get pumped up. So I sent him my copy. I was like, you know what? If anyone should have this, you should have this. And it's like just this, you know,
Full
communal
circle,
greatness. A full circle moments. Absolutely. And I remember going into stores and being intimidated. You know, I was kind of a shy kid at the time, and didn't really feel like I fit into that picture. And being able to stump the guys in the record store that were selling Earth Crisis and Snapcase stuff by the boatload, and be like, "Hey, do you have any Integrity? Do you have any Pale Creation?" And they're like, "Oh, yeah, but it's not in stock right now." You know, kind of like blowing smoke. And I'm just like, looking back years later, Integrity was always the band for dudes like us that were like the dudes that didn't fit in anywhere else. You know, it was truly a band for the band of the Misfits, and I feel like why I've always gravitated towards them, and they've just kind of been, you know, they've been a part of my life for most of my life at this point. It's insane to think about.
Yeah, that was the first thing we ever talked about, was that you were like, I'm going to try and bring Integrity up here. And I was talking to Sean Moe, who was roading for Grade back then. And he's like, there's no way, you know, there's no way you're ever going to get those guys up here. And then here you are, fucking a member of the band years later.
You know what's funny is I remember I used to write him, and Dwid would like, you know, he'd be like, "Ah, we're not allowed in Canada." And that's all he would say. He's very mysterious, you know, like mirrors. And I'd be like, "Why not?" I was like, just punishing the poor dude. Like, you know, I was excited. You know, I just really wanted to be. That's the band I wanted to see more than anything. And I never gave up. I finally got them to play Toronto in like 2013. Like the first time they ever played Toronto was because I brought them over. You know, I was like, "All right, we have to do this. This has to like close the circle." And in high school, they had played Buffalo with State of Conviction. It was on the Seasons and the Size of Days tour. And my girlfriend at the time, it was her birthday. And I was like, "Dude, we go to the show. You can have 10 birthdays next week, every day. We do whatever you want. I have to see the show." And she's like, "Oh, absolutely not. You know, no way." And like, you know, it didn't happen. I tried to do the right thing. And then go, Integrity breaks up. You know,
Oh,
another full circle moment was reuniting the Melnick lineup in 2012 for that same reason. I'm sorry, 2014 for the same. You know, I had to get closure, pun intended. But you know.
I don't know, it's just so awesome that we get to kind of like live in this world where these heroes become peers, and then ultimately, like, you're able to kind of like give yourself these moments and give yourself these kind of like full circle things.
It's definitely wild, for sure.
It's, I remember Jay, Warzone Jay, trying to bring Warzone up at least like three times too, and the shows would just like never wind up happening.
No, never. I remember we saw Dirge play CBGBs once. I remember it was with Against the Grain and IDK, which are like some forgotten 90s bands. I totally remember. I remember Against the Grain to play with Madball because Rob Kabula was in Against the Grain at the time, but he
Yeah,
ended
you
up not.
brought Against the Grain did play Toronto though at was an Elmo show, right?
With Madball, yeah.
Oh, that Madball show. Okay, sorry,
Yeah.
yes.
I convinced Noel, I'm like, these guys should play. They're great. You know what I mean? And that was a full circle moment from seeing them at CB's and wanting to, you know, hopefully get more people into them at the time. And I really liked that full length back then. But I remember seeing Rabies at that show and just asking him. And he's just like, you know, "Oh, you know," everyone always had the excuse, "Oh, we tried, but we couldn't get over the border." But I think a lot of the bands back then didn't try because it was a daunting ordeal. You know what I mean? You didn't really have the wits to kind of clean yourself up and cross the border in a, you know, civil fashion. Most of these dudes were like, you know, turn it around, send it back. So
Well, you hear stories about bands trying to cross with like weapons or just like ungodly amounts of cash. And
yeah.
it's like, you can't do that.
One of the best times was pulling teeth. No, wait, no, it was Dave Morning. Dave Morning played in Chicago, and we had this genius idea to put all of our merch into the guitar cabinets. And then we put the screws back in, and we're like, "Ha ha ha! They'll never figure this out. Let's toss the screwdrivers. We'll pick up some screwdrivers when we're in Chicago." We get to Chicago, nobody has a screwdriver, so all the merch is just stuck in the guitar when we play.
That's awesome.
Or,
So, go on, sorry.
oh, I was just saying, there was another time when we wore all our merch.
There's
We
like
all
twelve
walked over. We're
teachers.
just like, how's it going? You know, we're definitely willing to try anything.
Yeah, well, it was that was like you'd hear these things like, oh yeah, if you stick it in your cab, they're not going to find it, or if you all wear different shirts, they're not going to find it, or
Right.
you just hope and pray that that was the time that you weren't going to get pulled in and have everything come out of the cabinet or come out of your body.
That's part of why I moved. You know, I just got sick of the struggle. I was like, you know what? If I'm just on the other side, I think my life would be a whole lot easier and I can do more things that I want to do. And that was a huge, huge role in me leaving.
Did Day of Mourning and Dirge overlap at all, or did you kind of do like a hard stop and you guys switch to doing Day of Mourning?
No, there was a hard stop in between Dirge and Day of Mourning because we had gotten into a bad van accident. We were on tour out east and far in Quebec, and we hit a deer or swerved to miss a deer, sorry. And ended up rolling the van, and Jay, our drummer, ended up losing a finger. It was real bad.
Holy shit.
And you know, we took some time off to just kind of like, you know, regroup, get ourselves together. And then when we came back, we're like, you know, like as I had mentioned earlier, we were still kind of figuring things out when we were in Dirge. But by Day of Mourning's time, we knew what we wanted to do, you know. And we're like, just start clean slate, you know what I mean? Let's start this new band and take what we know and kind of roll with it. And that's kind of why it gave it wings, you know, right out the gate. The time, it was lawless. It was just kind of like, you know, how bad can I piss this dude off? Let's go. That was kind of like the MO, you know?
It was also mean. Like hardcore was like kind of a mean thing in Toronto at that
Yeah.
point. Every group was mean to each other, and internally, everyone was mean to each other within
Yeah.
each group.
I think that's how we were raised. I think it's a product of the time. As I was mentioning, you know, being a dad now, it's like I'm take the total opposite approach. Like when I was a kid, shit was mean. You know what I mean? Your own parents would like this you and make fun of you or smack you up. And it was like everybody was going through that at the time, like in my circle, you know, like coming from like, you know, Italian Canadians at the time, all our parents were off the boat. They don't know any better. You know what I mean? So it was kind of like real harsh, not open-minded, I guess, you know, would be a way to put it. It was kind of like you're supposed to fit in this box where you're supposed to, you know, stay at home, get married, get a job, move out, have kids, repeat. And I didn't want to do that. I wasn't interested. I left home at an earlier age and I was like, I'm fucking out of here. I just want to play in bands. You know what I mean? That was it. And thankfully, I figured it out along the way.
And I think it's also becoming apparent in growing up, you realize, like you said earlier, how insecure everybody was. And like the fact that everyone had to like, you know, you're not part of this thing, you weren't here for this event, or you're not part of this thing, you weren't there for that. And it was like everyone's psychological damage being played out, kind of replicating that within this sort of like ultimately way cooler, potentially amazing social thing that we kind of had going on.
Yeah, it was like truly like an island of misfits, like the island of unwanted toys, you know? But
Yeah.
I'm glad it's not like that anymore because, like, you know, anyone that waxes nostalgic about, oh, those were the good old days, you really have to earn it. And it's just like, nah, it sucked, dude. You know, it's just like being able to like talk to anybody about anything now is like such a better flex. I like that. I like that way better. It's way more my speed. It's giving me a chance to really be the person I am versus the person I thought I had to be to survive, you know, because it's brutal. You know,
Yeah.
it's like it's coming at you at all times. You always have to be ready, like mentally sharp to be able to be like defend yourself verbally or otherwise. And now she's just kind of like, all right, sure, there's room for everybody.
And
I'm gonna
strong
do it.
intentions not jumping on every show anymore.
Oh my gosh, you know, it's I'm in the home of Strong Intention now. I'm in Maryland and they're from Hagerstown. I
Might.
gotta admit, you know what I mean? It's I can't knock the hustle. It was funny that they would always appear on everything. But though they were guys just trying to do it like everybody else, and they just, you know, figured out a way to make it work. So I can't, you know. And that first 7-inch was pretty good.
It was not actually, I'm not gonna lie, I like the second 7-inch way more than that first one when they kind of
Well, when
changed the
ETH,
sound.
the split with Everybody Gets Hurt, or the actual like second
The
7-inch
actual second one when they became like a tragedy kind of worship
is the
band.
failure. It was good.
Yeah.
Good shit.
The one I remember going to see them and buying the basketball jersey at the show at the 360. So that was
Oh yeah,
the
everyone had that jersey. That jersey.
everyone had that jersey.
And I remember we were supposed to stay with Warzone J because we were supposed to play with Strong Intention in London one time. And Warzone J lied about us being allowed to stay at his house. So we had to sleep in the van parked outside of his house. And somehow, you know, it just came synonymous with Strong Intention after that. Everything was Strong Intention's fault, even though there's a direct correlation between the two. I just remember being at the time being like, It's a fucking strong intentions ball, you know what I mean? But no, it's like, I respect everything they've done. It's like they work hard just like anybody else, you know. I remember seeing Left 4 Dead at one of those. It was one of the shows Warzone was supposed to play.
Yeah,
Right?
the African Cultural Center.
No, this was at 360. This was might have been the last ones, and it wasn't with Beckman. It was with Christian McMaster playing instead of Jeff. It was like at
And
the
Joel
very end.
Fisher lineup, right? Joel Fisher was on the other guitar, I think.
Yeah, on the very end,
Yeah.
and it was almost a swarm at that point. And Callahan had his cowboy hat and just being fucking floored. And I was like, this is unfucking real. That Left 4 Dead, the second, like the 7-inch to split with Ochre, Hatebreed Under the Knife, like that shit was like just fucking such a huge hit me. Like that shit hit, that's what I wanted to do. And and it was kind of like intimidating. Chris was a well-liked guy and he was like a fixture in the scene at the time. And we were, like I said, with these fucking dorks. But like, I just remember seeing him at a Dystopia show. And he's like, you're in that band, right? And I was like, oh, geez. And then he proceeds to drop his pants and pee because he's in a urinal next to me. And he like just drops his pants and takes a whiz in the urinal next to me and with his pants completely down, just talking to me. And I'm just like, this is weird. I'm gonna go now. And but I remember, yeah, he's a great dude. We've remained friends this whole time. I did. I brought Left 4 Dead. I was the first person to bring Left 4 Dead over here years later. Only show out of the U.S. at the time. I mean, out of Canada into the U.S., forgive me. And
Yeah.
yeah, that was a huge, huge. All the shit was like just such a, it's like a tapestry. You know what I mean? You're weaving together all this great, these great moments in Toronto and Southern Ontario history. And it kind of laid the groundwork for everything that came after it when I moved.
Yeah, so I guess Day of Mourning toured though, right? Like you guys did quite a bit. You guys toured the States
Yeah,
a
we
few
toured a
times.
lot. And we actually broke up on the eve of a full US tour. Our drummer had some other stuff come up. And, a month and a half was down the drain all of a sudden. I had nothing to do and I had to stay at my stupid job that I didn't want to be at anymore. And of all stupid things to happen, I get an email from Rick DeLife that's like, yo, we looking for guitar player to go to Europe. And I'm like, it's probably worded like that too, And I was like,
Yeah.
okay, you know what I mean? I got nothing else going on. Why not? And I replied. And these at the time were just generic like spams to like, promote whatever Back to Basics records he was doing at the time. And I just wrote him back. I was like, hey, I know all these songs. I could learn them on the bus ride down there. Let's do it. And he wrote back. He's like, all right. So, that was it, man. I fucking got on a Greyhound bus with $300, my guitar, and a backpack full of clothes. And that was fucking it. Sayonara. I left. That was the
Wow.
end. That was the end of the Canada chapter. That was it.
Because I don't 25 to Life I know was supposed to play here a couple times. I don't think Coming Correct did, right? But like, but you had met him before this in some
We
way,
used to
no?
train because
Oh yeah.
and I gotta clarify that I always differentiate the Rick of then versus the Rick of now. It's two different entities to me. It's like a Twin Peaks thing where the real Rick disappeared and another Rick appeared. So I'm purely speaking in a past context, but there. Despite all his business shortcomings, there was no better guy to like get the word out about any band, And he used to like get Day of Mourning stuff out, Dirge stuff out everywhere. So we would always be trading. And he was notorious for like not sending you what you traded. I'd be like, yeah, here's a box of Day of Mourning CDs. Send me some 25 to Life shit. And he's like, nah, but I got these Fat Nuts 7-inches and all this other shit. And I'm just like,
I will say Fat Nuts is one of the most underrated Back to Basics
I
bands.
will agree. But it was a hard sell. You know what I mean? No
Back
one did
then, yes, it
it,
was hard.
but.
Well, that's all that Back to Basics stuff. It's crazy now that all those records are collectible and like
And
so
they
many
actually,
people.
yeah, they fit in today's musical landscape. It's kind of weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's great. I
You
remember
were
that
ahead of curve. You were so ahead of the curve on this shit.
Bloodbath. But, and I had a distro of my own, and I used to like distro at shows and shit. So it was like, we knew of each other. I wouldn't call us friends. It's like we just knew each other from trading records. I used to trade with Jamie from Hatebreed. I used to trade with like everybody back then. That's what you did. So, by the time I hit him up, I guess there was a little bit more weight that I wasn't just some random guy that, I was a guy that he would depend on being there that would actually show up. And I showed up. I was on a Greyhound. I rolled into Baltimore. I showed up and he didn't. I'm in Baltimore, right? And I'm in the train station, the bus station, forgive me. And it was after like a 30-hour ride because the Greyhound doesn't go straight to Baltimore. It went through every stop in Pennsylvania, right? I was like, I had one tape that had the Weezer Green album on one side. some other show, the other rap mix on the other side. I had to listen to that for 30 something hours in my Walkman, but that was it. And got to Baltimore and he didn't show up. I was like, what the fuck? You know, there's no cell phones at the time. Got my backpack, I got my guitar, and I got $300. I'm like, I don't know what the fuck to do. And I went to find a payphone and I called him and he's like, oh, you're actually coming. And I was like, yeah, dude, I'm here. He's like, I'll be right there. And you know, lo and behold, like an hour later, he shows up, and that chapter of my life began. You know, it was actually pretty cool.
What was it like? Because you're like obviously in a band with people that you've been friends with the whole time when you're on tour, and then all of a sudden you're on tour with a legendarily intense person, and at any stage, you know, pretty intense. And then here you are in Europe with like a bunch of strangers.
It was, you know, for me, I've always been about music. Music's always been the reason why I do this. I love it. So I wanted to play the songs well. That's all I really cared about, you know what I mean? And get to see places I've never been. I wanted to see the world and play music. That was kind of it. And, you know, Rick and I got along for the most part. You know, he was a funny dude. He was like, you know, I used to live on his couch. And the way it worked was I lived on his couch, which was locked off from the rest of the house. So I didn't have a bathroom. I didn't have anything. I just had a living room with a couch. And if I left, he would lock the door. And I would have to find him to get back in the house. So if I had to brush my teeth, I would have to go to Dunkin' Donuts and brush my teeth, come back and fucking pray that he would like unlock the door and let me back in, right? He probably half the time he wouldn't. And I'd be like, oh, Jesus Christ, what am I gonna do? I would go play bingo like with the old ladies down the street. I had nothing to do. I was locked out, right? The van was gone, I was fucked. There was nothing to do. And you know, and then all that magic happened on the weekend. We would start rolling out to all these like weird places in Pennsylvania and in New Jersey, and like just all these small towns where like kids were like, wow, someone's coming. He was smart because he didn't do the big cities back then. He was very into, we're going to go to fucking all these small towns that nobody goes to. And that's going to be the bread and butter, you know, and it was. We'd play all these really weird places in Indiana. And like, you know, like I said, in Pennsylvania, anywhere that would have us, really, South Carolina. And it was always real fun. And like, you know, there's never any money in it. But that was also the time where I was doing that. That's where I met the dudes that would eventually do Pulling Teeth and Slumlords with, because those dudes were also just cutting their teeth, just trying to play, right? They're like, hey, here's a band that actually tours. I'm just going to do it and see what happens, you know? And that's like all those friendships. That was the nucleus. Everything that came after it was because of that. So I got to give Rick credit, despite, you know, it's the Rick of yesterday, for kind of being a linchpin in my life at that point and setting off all these new friendships and relationships that, you know, kind of defined the next 20 plus years of my life for sure.
Did you know, did you meet Jeff Perlin like that time when Breakdown played at Shanghai?
No, but I remember them walking Warzone J to the ATM. I met later. It was my stint with Rick didn't last long. I was in the band for about a year and a half. We did Europe, we did a bunch of stuff, and I realized I didn't like being somebody else's band. You know, I was like, this is cool. It gave me a lot of experience, but it was like, this isn't what I want to do, you know? And the dudes in Next Step Up had another band called Wake Up Cold, who were going to Europe. And I was like, they needed a guitar player to go. And I was like, you know, I'll go. If you pay for the ticket, I don't need anything else. You know what I mean? I'll ride for free. And I did another Europe tour with those dudes, with JR, and, you know, all those dudes looked out. They were really great. But when it came back, I was like, I got to start my own band. I'm not really feeling doing this anymore. And I saw Perlin at a show at the Sidebar. Again, I brought up that show where they walked Warzone J to the ATM machine, right? We're just like talking. And him and Scott that plays drums and Stout, and Doug that plays bass and Stout. And I'm like, you know, we should get together and jam. I got an idea for this band. I really want it to be like, you know, just like 80s hardcore. All like the early 80s New York stuff crossed with the late 80s New York stuff, and just kind of not really much metal to it. And he was game. So we met up and we jammed, did some Black Flag songs and just fucked around. And that's kind of how Slumlords came about. It was that easy. We were all like real like simpatico with our sense of humor and just general weirdness, you know what I mean? So it was I love Jeff Justice, like one of my favorite people I've ever had a chance to be in a band with or be friends with. He's hilarious. Funniest dude, hands down.
Yeah, like I think that's the thing is you know, obviously very intimidating kind of presence, and certainly on stage, but a hilarious lyricist, like
Oh my
really
God, and
writes
like,
some awesomely funny songs.
and his banter is like second to none. Like when he would say shit like, "This goes out to the frigid eras of hardcore, Sub-Zero," and everyone's just like, you know, like it's just, like he was like, you know, dad jokes before dad jokes were cool. You know, he was just dropping them. I remember we played with Terror once in No Warning, and he just shouted out Terror and let out this eagle screech that was like a minute long, like way longer than it should have been, right? And everyone's just like, the audience, listen, right? They're like,
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So yeah, Lords were such like a hilarious band. Like the vibe was so cool, and it was a great time, kind of that period for hardcore, because it felt like all the walls were kind of breaking down between all the different scenes, and like there were these shows where all these different sorts of bands were playing together, and you could have Coal World on tour with Iron Age or Sexvid, and then you could also have, you know, that gut instinct, like you, because of you, we got to play with Gut Instinct, you know, like
Yeah,
talking about
it was
walls breaking
a half
down.
version, but you know, I think it was like much like we had talked about before, it was the vision we all realized when we were younger that a bigger network of people that are friends just because they like hardcore, you know, and you're able to be like, hey, if you like hardcore and that's cool, we don't even have to like the same thing. We're all on the same team, you know? And Slumlords was lucky to be around during that Posse Numbers era, I like to call it, you know. We played Posse Numbers, we played Sync with Cali. We managed to go to Europe. We did a record on Locking Out. We did like some pretty cool stuff. Slumlords is like a weird band because it's kind of like fallen with the beatdown resurgence that's going on now. A lot of people forgot about the Slumlords era in Baltimore hardcore. It was like a window where, it, you know, if there was a Slumlords show, people were coming from all over the East Coast, and it was guaranteed to be a party. That show was fucked up. You know, we put you guys in Cold World and Cro-Mags, and we did that little Gut Instinct mini set in there. It was like, you know,
It was awesome.
that was the norm. That was like what we would do, and it was just like, it was a great way to just bring people together. And the whole reason was just have a good time and nothing more. You know, there was never like a ulterior motive with that one. We just wanted to party with our friends, and everybody was our friend. You know, as long as you weren't a dick, it's cool.
It's interesting when you look at this era of hardcore as being, like you said, like the influence of like kind of Baltimore and I guess DC, lumping the two areas in together. Like with the beatdown stuff, also with like all these bands kind of vibing and trying to sound like 86 Mentality now, or you know, the Turnstile phenomena. Like that's like really like the sonic center of a lot of the stuff that's happening now, is that sort of like Baltimore stuff from that starts in that period.
I agree. And it's real wild to think that, like, if you told me back in the Warzone J days that, you know, like 20 plus years from now, everyone's going to try to sound like Bulldoze, like, you know, sign me up. Sounds like Valhalla, you know? I'll be there. And it's like, you know, but yeah, it's always just been a really great caliber of bands that came from this area. I mean, the East Coast in general. That's why I gravitated towards here. But, like, you know, Stout and 86 Mentality. I mean, if you take it even further back to Next Step Up or Gut Instinct, it's like Baltimore always had like a real meat and potatoes, like real caveman. And I use the word dumb, but I don't mean like stupid. Like they were just like the riffs were dumb. You know what I mean? There was like real plotting and like hard and like just fucking. And then, you know, and I think that just it's in its truest form. And authenticity is what resonates with everybody. It doesn't feel contrived. So people are able to take influence from that and build on that and do something. It's a real stable foundation and do something cool and go off of that. So I like seeing those bands get their due. It means a lot. You know, it's like the team you grew up loving, seeing them finally like get their day, you know?
Yeah, and it's, I feel like there's like a lot of style jumping that happens in hardcore, and it's very trendy, you know, and stuff. But like I can honestly say you have been repping that stuff in your distro when like you would get cracked on in hardcore, not cracked, like physically cracked on, but people like, you know, like there was kind of like a snobbery
Oh
put
yeah.
towards a lot of that stuff.
I mean, like it's funny because if you listen to Day of Mourning now, and you know, it's like I said before, it was like my records, any record I do is like find it when you find it, or if you don't find it at all, that's okay too. But it's like Dave Mourning was like 30 years ahead of most of the bands that are like are doing that now, but most people don't even know and probably won't ever know. But I've loved that shit a long time, you know what I mean? And I'll always rep it. I always love like crossing over of like beat down and like death metal and like just real aggressive, evil cauldron of stuff, you know. And I always thought that's always been my bread and butter. I never deviated. Even the last record I did with Enrain, like 30 years later, it's still that, you know. It's just kind of like what I like doing.
You have your Maryland's Vitamins loving side too, though. Don't deny that. You did a cover of that.
Dude, they're like my favorite Toronto punk band of all time. Best. See, their last show was like incredible at Elmo Combo. I still remember it vividly. I could shut my eyes and still remember like the energy in the air. It was like unlike anything I'd ever seen before.
It's interesting how there's like a real, you know, and once again, I say Toronto, but it obviously I mean like surrounding area, but there's like a real Toronto band phenomena where like bands would be just big locally. And like, you can't really appreciate how big some of these bands were. Like Maryland's Vitamins was so, like you're talking about that last show. That was like an epic event. I think there was like a newspaper article about that when that happened.
Oh, it was magic. But a lot of the bands, and it's a greater thing than just underground music, don't really carry traction over into the US or other countries. Canada was like an isolated bubble for the most part. You know what I mean? We had our own everything. We had our own radio, our own CanCon, Canadian content. And like, you know, like it was really championing, like, you know, the supporting of the Canadian artists, but at the same time, they weren't integrating it with the rest of the world. So it was very isolated and weird. It was very like pockets.
There were certain bands though, right? Like you think like Grade, Chokehold, Propagandhi.
Yes.
Cryptopsy, I guess if you lump them in somehow, just like underground music wise. Like were bands that seemed like they had big followings in the US back in the 90s.
Yeah, another one that is interesting that falls into that bubble world is this bunch of fucking goofs.
Yeah.
I mean, epic. Yeah. I've seen like, you know, monumental BFG shows, but like no one south of the border. Like, even are they who? What? Like, I'm amazed to hear that Daigle Abortion still play, and they're one of my favorites. So it's like, you know, seeing like that they're still going and they're still playing shit in the US is great. But like, yeah, Canada was its own like whole ecosystem almost, you know?
Yeah, I think that border did, like, you know, as much as you're saying, like, bands were intimidated to kind of cross from the US, I think Canadian bands too. Absolutely. And the idea, you know, Canadian punk band trying to tour across Canada as their like touring thing, it's like that drive's gonna, you know, unless you're in a bus, it's a gnarly drive to try and do over and over again.
We did it. Dirge did it, and this was before the internet, man. It was like, it was brutal, you know what I mean? Going across was like, wow, like, where do you play, you know? But it was like that thing, you play in Regina, Saskatoon. I still hear from people like I was at that show, and there was like seven people at that show, so it's like, it goes to show like how small and like what a big deal it was. And I remember Callahan telling me that Countdown to Oblivion, I remember they went out east and they totally hit the Maritimes and hit those places that nobody had hit at the time. And it was just like, Canada was there for the taking. You know what I mean? All they needed was someone to show up. And some of our best shows were in those places. Like Day Morning in Halifax is still like one of the best shows I've ever played in my life. It's just nobody went out there, you know?
Who did you play with in Halifax back then?
We played with a band called Equation of State.
Oh, I kind of remember that.
I remember this. It was this guy, Ian Hart.
Yeah.
He booked the shows back then, and it was his band, and they were like a screamo, an Ebullition type band. And yeah, you know what I mean? It was that easy. It'd be just writing this dude I never knew, and it was like, hey, we want to play Halifax. Can you make it happen? He's like, okay. And that was it, you know? That's all it took back then.
Yeah. And it's interesting because you could do that anywhere in the world. Like, if you could get there, you could find a kid that was going to do your show.
Interestingly enough, I think the logic also applies to other parts of the world, because like when Day Morning started coming into the US, we would play real isolated places like Poughkeepsie, New York, or you know, Mass. And we played with like bands like Dissolve and Overcast and Candiria, who at the time, you know, were like, we play these shows and they were huge. People were like just going mental, right? And I'm like, then you see these bands outside of their local region, and it's just like, you know, seeing whatever band playing, it's just a normal event, you know? And it just made me hip to like the regional magic that comes with like being really popular in a certain area and working it. Cause I remember Overcast played like Who's Emma, and I think there was like 10 people there.
Yeah.
It was fucking sick, don't get me wrong. But like, I remember seeing them, like, you know, like people. It's the same thing with Upstate New York and all the Troy bands. They were like, it was like an anomaly. They were like headlining over the the touring bands. You know, it was just it was wild. The power of the regional drum, big thing back then.
And there was regional and like regional sounds, right? Like bands like had like areas had certain types of music that would hit in that area, and like these bands would get huge. Like I remember hearing like about Furia Five and how big Furia Five were in their hometown, and the football team would like go on the field to Furia Five.
Yeah. Same with E Town, and I remember seeing E Town play in Buffalo with Hatebreed, and it was like, you know, it was not what I had imagined. They were great, don't get me wrong. They played perfectly, but like, you know, years later, when you if YouTube existed and you could cross reference what a hometown show would look like versus what that Buffalo show looked like, it would be night and day, you know.
I guess Hatebreed's also the first band that was kind of like able to break out of that regional bubble and go, you know, I guess Madball obviously, but New York's so different. Like New York's got like a built-in branding, but like Hatebreed was like the first band to kind of break out of that regional scene and just go international and take over.
I loved Hatebreed. Remember the first time they finally made it to Toronto? There was like the cancellations. Then they finally showed up and everybody was, and you know, it's my favorite
2 a.m.
era.
2 a.m. they showed up that day.
Yeah. And it was like my favorite era because it was the pre-positive, still like kind of scummy version of Hatebreed, where it wasn't clean, wasn't refined yet, you know, anything goes. And, you know, they still had like Lou Boulder in the band and stuff, rest in peace. And it was like, it was the best, dude. It was so sick. It was just like, and everybody, you know what I mean? It was like one of those legendary shows where everyone's on the same page when it came to Hatebreed. Everyone was there. They loved them, you know, to have a good time.
And because they had played before when they played with the Voorhees at Who's Emma.
Yeah. No, was it a, yeah, I thought it was 360.
Was it 360? It means 360. I didn't go to the show, but
no, me neither. But I knew of it because I did my homework. But
Simon Harvey did that show.
Who did?
Simon Harvey.
Oh yeah.
Which is funny to think of him doing a Hatebreed show.
Yeah. But no, it was like, you know, they were instrumental, I think, in bridging the two worlds, because all of a sudden it was like the U.S. bands were started coming to the U.S. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think it was a lot to do with that John Finberg and Noel connection. Because all those bands started working with Finberg's agency in the U.S. and then Noel was bringing them over, and you know, all these bigger bands were playing, and it was like, it was great. You know, people got to see Bloodlet. You know what I mean? People got to see like it's another really great one. The Candiria started coming and popping off. You know what I mean? Candiria became like a headlining band.
When King Diamond came and you guys opened for King Diamond?
No, we didn't open for King Diamond.
Oh, I thought you guys opened. Or, you know, you did this, got him to do a sample or something, right?
No, we got hired to just drive him from the hotel to the venue, right? In the day morning van. And, dude, like I had said earlier, you know, I mean, I was a fucking prick when I was a younger version of myself. I deserve to be smacked. But I was just like, decided I was going to fucking punish this poor dude's entourage, right? And I had a million questions. I'm like, all right, the van breaks down on the side of the road. Wheel pops off the axle. Only person can get out and help is King Diamond, but he's in full makeup. Doesn't do it. And the handler's just like, just kicked me out of my own van. They drove my van to pick up King Diamond. And I had to just like, wait, just like, nah, that happened. And, you know, just dumb shit. You know what I mean? Just fucking come from that rope. But so, you know, I never got to meet King Diamond. Shane, as a Coalition Against Shane fame did. That's why he was on the cover of the record with King Diamond.
Oh, that's like, what I'm thinking of. I'm
confused. It's a fuck you to me and Mike, because he's just like, you know.
Yeah.
One up you guys. And then we're like, we went up you. We put it on the record cover, you know? So it's always like a constant, like.
Yeah. Oh, that's
all. Ourselves. But I did get my one jab in. When he wanted honey for his tea, I got him like the teddy bear honey. I thought that was fun. My kids love that story. They're like, oh, tell us the time you gave King Diamond the teddy bear honey. I'm just like, all right, you know. But
didn't he want a ton of ice, too? Or like dry ice? It was at the Elmo, and there was like, you know, it's like once again, probably a low period for King Diamond playing the Elmo.
Yeah, it was
combo.
the Voodoo tour, I think. I
yeah, yeah. And it was, but like, you know, a classic show. Twisted Sister played the Gasworks, I remember, too, around then.
You know, we played the Gas, Dirge had played the Gasworks on one of those shows I had mentioned before where we like hauled all our gear on the subway. We played the Gasworks a few times. And it was, yeah, you know, we came. Like Jason, our drummer, his older brother was in a lot of bands that were like Toronto bands at the time. Like Wire Alive was one of them that would play places like Gasworks or the Marquee out in Scarborough.
Oh yeah.
So like that's where we cut our teeth. That's where we, you know, that was our point of entry. And yeah, it's kind of sad that none of those places are there. I was just over visiting over the holidays last year, and like none of Toronto, I was showing my wife around. I'm like, none of the stuff is like here, that was here, you know, that used to be there, that used to be there. Callahan's still there if you look, you see him. But it's like,
It's Toronto's a city that hates its history and
yeah.
then laments that there's no history here.
Best venue of all time for me. Do you remember the concert hall, the Masonic Temple?
Absolutely.
It was a dream to get to play there, and we were obsessed. And we figured out a scam with the remember those Supernova Battle of the Bands?
Yeah.
So we played one of those shows because it was at the concert hall. And how many tickets you sold for these guys dictated your position on the bill, right? And they would give you 100 tickets, and if you sold 100 tickets, you got first choice of the bill. And I'm like, we sold 98 tickets, and they're like, oh my God, you guys killed it. I'm like, our singer's not here yet. He'll bring the tickets and the money. You know, he said there's two left and there's 98 tickets sold. He's like, all right, cool. You know, you guys are in this slot. So we hit prime booking. It was like, 10 o'clock at night at a concert hall in a room full of other kids and bands and whatnot. Come the end of the night, I'm like, oh fuck, I misunderstood. He sold two tickets and 98 tickets. Here you go, here's $40. Only time I ever paid to play, but I had to make it happen. I really wanted to play at the fucking concert hall. And we did it, you know. You have to have sharp scruples to make it happen.
I think I only saw one show at the concert hall back in the day. Like, I eventually got to play there when it was MTV, but like, I saw it, Project Nine with Gypsy Soul.
Oh my God, remember Project Nine was a weird band, dude. Remember the dude with the big necklace?
Yes.
Small world, because the guy that would master the Day of Mourning records, Roland Rainier, was in Project Nine. I think he was the drummer. And
That's
like,
awesome.
I remember seeing them with Mr. Bungle at the Opera House, and I was just like, it went over my head. You know what I mean? This is too weird for me. I couldn't really grasp it at the time, but I always
That's
appreciate it.
well, that's what you're saying. Like, like how Day of Mourning now, like the sound's kind of caught up to what the sound you guys were going for back then. I would love to kind of hear Project Nine now. 'Cause yeah, at the time I was like, what the fuck is this? But
Right. Yeah.
now I wonder if it would be something that I would have caught up to and be like, oh, this is fucking incredible. This is
Like a
really
mature
good.
lens. You know,
Yeah, yeah.
we played with a band called Plastic Witches back then in the 90s that broke up on stage in their second song. It was just like, whoa, this is like the weirdest shit I've ever seen. And I've always been obsessed with like finding their demo just to like kind of like satisfy that itch, like you're saying, you know, and just being like, I wonder what, you know, through today's lens, what this would look like, what this would sound like, you know, and it would be cool.
Well, that also brings up this thing that I'm always kind of obsessed with now. It's like true rarity, like stuff that like just doesn't exist. Like there's like people that be like, oh, the rarest records like this Beatles Butcher Baby sleeve, right? Or this thing. It's like,
Right.
no, but people held on to those. People collected those. Like these demos, no one kept it.
No, and it's amazing. You know, it's like an attitude that I was exposed to that I really appreciated was, you remember that band Iyer from Montreal? That was
Absolutely, yeah.
Black Hand. I was really interested in reissuing their stuff because they're like one of my favorite bands at the time. And I hit up Radwan and asked him if they would be interested in doing it. And his attitude about it was, nah, he goes, thank you, but unless you were there. You know what I mean? It's a time and place thing. And I really love that. It was kind of like, yeah, I was there. I got to see it, you know? And that's the rarity that you're speaking of. It's like people never know what it's like to be in someone's living room and have Iyer roll up with like 20 Marsh stacks and just like fucking destroy the
It makes
room.
you, and it makes you kind of like, it makes you at one time like just have a completely different appreciation for someone that as a young person is like, no, what we're doing now is important and valid, and I'm going to build like not an empire in a sort of an evil way, but like build an empire around it. Like people like Ian MacKaye or Fat Mike, like people that believed in their own shit so much that they like made it important, and obviously they're making great music, but at the same time they also believed in it and told us all that they were making great music and put the records out there and make sure that stuff's kept in print and it's not a time and a place thing. It becomes part of the canon.
Yeah, I like both sides of the coin. I think both hold weight, you know what I mean? It's cool that there's like, regional phenomena that if you were there, you'll remember it. And if not, c'est la vie. But it's also cool that there's some stuff that, yeah, you know, it's like Dwiz also done a really great job of that with the Integrity Records. He's made sure they're in print for generations and generations, you know what I mean? There's always new generations discovering those records. And
Yeah.
it's great.
Well, integrity is such a weird one too, because I think it's also the obscurity of it too. Like the fact that it was always accessible, but the fact that it was always there's weird versions of this thing, or there's like this one thing that's out of print, or this song that no one's heard, or a mix of some song, or like,
Right.
but yet, like you're saying, it was always accessible enough that like you could kind of get into the mystery. And depending on how far you wanted to go after that was up to you.
Think it comes down to like your artist statement, where it's like, sometimes you just want to do something to do it, and that's it, you're done, wipe your hands. And then other people really want to build a legacy off of it, you know what I mean? And both of them serve equal purpose and value. And I think it's just, I think there's room for both. I think it's cool.
Yeah, it's interesting. I find like that's when and this is because of you that this all happened. When Jeff from Cold as Life came on the podcast, I found his motivation behind doing Cold as Life just so different than, someone like Dwid's motivation for doing Integrity, where one is sort of this sort of like, still like ultimately awesome and fucked up, but like artistic expression that you're sharing and putting out in this world and defined aesthetic. And one is almost like being done because you have to. Like there has to be some sort of
I guess
fucking
it's like almost
release.
feral, It's like, yeah, I don't know anything else. Yeah, I agree. And it's what's also interesting in parallel lanes, they both had long standing careers where in 2023 both bands are still talked about and loved, despite
And
going
both,
down different avenues.
yeah, and neither one was like ever critically lauded, even in punk and hardcore during their day at the time. Like it was, there always had, like regional fans and always huge. And Integrity had definitely like a, I think a larger international presence even back then, but it was still so cult-like.
They both had the mythos of like being in the pre-internet era where it was all secondhand hearsay and stories, right? And it was like, oh, I heard like Frank pulled three guns out on this dude, or I heard like this huge brawl fucking burst out at St. Andrew's Hall. And
Dwid
it's
has
like,
a bastard sword that he brings on tour. I remember
and there's
that one.
never any way to really like verify this stuff. And it was just, you just relied on those rumors and you kind of like tailored your own version of what you wanted it to be. And I think that's cool. I think it's just kind of, it made it a little more special. It's like fan fiction.
And it was great because when these bands would occasionally make it up to Toronto, it was like seeing them so removed from that element. Like to see Stigmata and Troy would be a completely different experience than seeing them
Oh
at 2 in the
my
afternoon on a Tuesday.
God. That was so bizarre. That was one of the most bizarre shows I've ever seen. And Cold as Life, when they finally played Toronto, was at the Cathedral on the Domination Tour, I remember. And it was like, most of the room was pretty much Windsor show rolled up, and it was like, it was cool, but it wasn't like, seeing them out that way. It was like a completely different vibe,
Yeah, it was like a unique kind of experience getting to see, and there's like, and because like you're saying, Jay and Noel and yourself and these bands would come up here. Like you would get a chance to see a lot of these bands that, didn't necessarily play all the hot spots.
absolutely. It was just great, as a fan of those records and those bands, just getting to see them. And also, it was a big deal, A, getting to share the band with like our peers and hopefully turn people onto this band so they'll come back, but also, make the band want to come to our city and like fucking, see our bands and be like, maybe they'll see one of the bands, they liked one of the opening bands, and they'll invite them to play somewhere else. That's kind of how it worked back then. And it was always cool.
Yeah, like I think it's like buying the Fat Nuts 7-inch out of your distro, but then also having like Simon Harvey sell me the Bastard CD out of his distro, and then having like whatever garage rock records they've got at Full Blast that they're introducing people to, and then stuff at Who's Emma, the Ebullition stuff at Who's Emma. Like it felt like it was a small enough place that we got to sample all this different types of hardcore, where in other places you might have to stick to a scene a little bit more.
We were really lucky to have Who's Emma. I mean, like, I try to explain that to like, my friends now, because like there was really nothing like it. You know what I mean? There was an air of like pompousness to it. So don't get me wrong. There was a very like, like clandestine, like, you could only know so much. We know all the hardcore secrets about what you're allowed, what's cool. And I'm just like, but yeah, I was able to get a Morser record and like all this cool shit. I was able to like, my big thing is my girlfriend at the time volunteered there, the same one that fucking made me miss Integrity. But I would go hang out when she worked there, and I had free rein over the whole store to listen to whatever I wanted to and be able to be like, oh, I can't wait because I have enough money to buy that Morser record, or like, this is what I want to buy next. And it's like, It was like almost like having a library at your fingertips. Just like cool shit, you know? Acne for the first time in there. And like it was magical.
And it was the, I think the part of the magic too is because we still had these physical spaces, you could have shows there. There could be art galleries there. There could be like people meeting up in these spaces. And this was like available to anyone and everyone. And it feels like that is not the case anymore. Like I can't think of too many places that certainly like Who's Emma that operate that freely where you just call up, be like, hey, is there a show there tonight? No? Okay, I'm gonna put a show on.
Yeah, that's where I met Mike too. Mike from your band was also a desk jockey over there. And I mean, in Baltimore, when I moved here, we had a place called Charm City Art Space, which was a similar aesthetic, but it didn't have the record store part. So the introducing to music element was removed. And I think that was a big deal. What made Who's Emma so magical? You know what I mean? I could go in there and talk to remember that dude Noah? What was his
No
band?
gaggy.
He was in the Power Violence band,
Yeah, it was
Godzilla.
Godzilla.
Godzilla, right? Yeah, and I can't believe I remember that, but just being like, "Oh yeah, you think that's cool? Well, check this out." And like, it was just great. You didn't even have to know these guys, and they'd be like, "Well, you think that's cool? Check this out." And like, it was always like a constant exchange of like, "Hey, I made you this tape. You might like some of this shit. Check it out." You know, and like, it was just it's. I hate to be like, old man waxing nostalgic, but that's a fucking thing that's never gonna happen again. You know, that era, that magic of hand to hand exchanging and turning people on to shit is just like. From an era, a bygone era, it's just not a thing anymore, and it's sad because it was fucking, it was cool.
Well, it's like that's the thing that happens when you have the death of manufacturing. Like we had physical products, like you needed to meet up to exchange these things, right? And like it wasn't necessarily a capitalist thing because, as you're saying, no one's making money doing any of
Oh.
this shit, right? But there was this sort of like physical product being exchanged for cash thing that would happen, and it was like our own economies. Like you could go there and then go to the vegan bakery, buy something there, and you could kind of like keep the money kind of
The
kind of the
community.
market. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It was magical, you know?
Yeah. And that's the thing that I think, and it's, I don't think we're net waxing nostalgic because I think it's just changed, and there's like stuff that's certainly a lot easier. Like you were saying, like if you didn't have that guy who ran the studio space to help you guys do that CD or make a video and submit it to Much Music, like who the fuck would have heard of you that quickly, right? Like,
Yeah.
but now you can do that yourself, no problem.
Anybody could, you could just, just throw it online. And I think it's great, but it also has created like such an influx that it's impossible. It's like a constant tidal wave, you know what I mean? It's like fighting the ocean, as they say, where it's like, hey, I put out a record, here it goes. And then 20 other records just come and topple it over like within 5 minutes, It's just like, it's a different time and place, for sure.
I think it's also we don't have like so much of the culture was magazine driven back then and like review driven, right? So you'd have a longer shelf life or legs for a record because the magazine would come out kind of 2 months afterwards sometimes and you'd be reading about it in a zine and you're like, oh
That's a
shit, I gotta.
true lost art.
Yeah.
I was talking about that with the, when the En Ryn record came out, because there's a website called Aversion Online that like really does awesome reviews, and like they're able to write a review that'll make me want to listen to a record the way like they describe it. They're like real good. And that's like a lost art, because that's how we used to find out about stuff back then. You'd read like the very, very distro magazine, and you'd be like, that's how I found out about Starkweather or like all these cool bands. They're like, oh, if you like evil, like dark and metallic, this and that, this is what, you should check this out. And I did, and seldom was disappointed. And the power of the printed word is just shot, because people don't have the attention span for it anymore. It's just instant gratification. They'll click and listen to 10 seconds. Maybe they'll listen to the rest, and maybe not. It's like, it's a different approach.
Yeah, you read those catalogs. Like I probably still know the Victory magazine backwards to and forwards.
Remember
Is
the
that
Bloodlet description?
no, so now you caught me out. No, what was
I
it?
always tease them. I'm always like, if you're willing to spill blood, you're allowed to listen to these Viridians. And they were just like, yeah, we didn't write that. I'll never forget that, because I'm like, what does that mean? I have to hear this.
I
Sign me
think
up.
that's also where I read Jamie saying that thing that I love to tease him about from Hatebreed, where he's like, Hatebreed was inspired by Quicksand. I heard Quicksand and was like, and someone told me it was a hardcore band, And I couldn't believe people were calling that shit hardcore. So I wanted to make the most anti-quicksand possible, quicksand band possible.
Hell yeah.
Oh, it's awesome. Like how competitively inspiring everything was back then. Like you hated a band, you're
I got to
inspired.
meet Tony Victory. Integrity played in Chicago when I was still in the band, and he had come out to the show. It's the first time I'd met him. And I've admired, say what you want about the guy, but like that Victory Records in the 90s was like, it was like having bread in the house, you know what I mean? It was a staple. So I go, I'm not gonna waste your time. I just want to know about three records real quick. Integrity, Systems Overload. And he goes, too many solos. And then I said, Dead Guy, Fixation on a Coworker. And he goes, great record. Then I'm going, Bloodlet, Entheogen. And he looks at me and he goes, Florida Rednecks, Fretless Bass. And he just kind of like disappeared into the background, and that was it.
Yeah, I got this in a dollar bin in Portland. This is the Awake 7-inch, right?
Oh, wow. Okay.
On Skeen Records. And this is one of the ones on purple vinyl. And Victory distroed 100 copies on purple vinyl before it's Victory. And so inside, there's a one sheet for their new signing, Integrity, who are still referred
Oh,
to
wow.
as a
Look at
straight edge
that.
band. And then on the dust sleeve, the guy's written, Tony Victory has written, Jeff Spiegel, who's the guy who owns Skeen Records, I will break your neck, sinner.
Whoa.
And then there's a letter inside from Tony to the kid that ordered the 7-inch, explaining that how much he hates the dudes that run Skeen Records.
Oh, jeez.
Signed by him at the bottom. Some of the best things I've ever found in a record store.
That's incredible.
Yeah, but these people were, you're like folk heroes, like not even like, 'cause it's not necessarily heroes because it's punk, but at the same time, like you heard about some of these people so much. And like you're saying, there's no internet. So by the time, like even now, when you get to finally meet these people, you're like, oh my God, like meeting Jeff for the first time, or like even talking to Dwid for the very first time, like
Right. It's
just
just,
like, holy shit, like so weird. I've heard so many legends.
I'm so glad to have met them later in life, though, and not during the height of their powers, where like, they were almost obligated to be the persona that they were perceived to be. I'm glad, like, get to just know the real
Yes.
version of those dudes. They're just regular dudes, but
But and I'm not talking about those two guys in particular, but like in general, going back to like Rick, you've always been able to kind of work with people that are otherwise known as being difficult or feared or spoken about in kind of hushed tones in a way, like even you did a Mighty Sphincter record.
It's someone once called me the hardcore whisperer, which was funny because it's just like being able to. But any of those situations, and all honestly, just involved a direct like, I just fucking love your band, dude. I just want to, do something cool. It's never been like I want to make money off your back or I want to change what you're doing. I just want to like, help you do what you're doing. And I guess they saw the earnest appeal to what I was offering at the time, because all of those friendships are still intact. I'm still friends with all those dudes and talk to them all the time despite years going by. There's been seldom an experience since I got into this that I have an enemy or anyone I dislike in general. It's just kind of like it's been cool, but I always feel like I've walked the straight and narrow with stuff like that. So it's just been because I love the music and not because I'm trying to elevate any sort of status or do anything else. So it's just been like, I want people to hear this. I want more people to hear this. What can I do to make that happen,
I love the catalog too. When you go through your label, there's like so much weird, cool, interesting stuff for like from the bands we talked about to like nothing. There's just like a lot of like interesting records. Like it's in both eras, you've had really cool runs with the label.
With A389, with the wildest thing was, and most people don't know, is not only did I do A389, I worked a full-time job and had kids. And I would pretty much work my job from 8 until 4, come home and eat dinner and hang out with the kids and put them to bed at 7 o'clock because we were real young. And then I would go to the warehouse and pack orders and do label shit until like 3 or 4 in the morning, sometimes all the way until it was time to go to work the next day. And that was my life until I burned out and I stopped the label and I joined Integrity. But it's taken off, you know what I mean? It really had weight and it was able to be a platform, like for bands like Full of Hell and for nothing, and for like, you know, I'm trying to think what other bands really like springboarded off that. Those were like the two real big ones. Iron Reagan springboarded. That was the first record. You know, there's like, and all the time was also a way, my attitude was always to like get new bands and old bands and cross those worlds. So get old dudes to like new bands and get young kids to respect the old bands. And I always group these records together in a way that, hey, if you bought the new Integrity, if you spend like, you know, add 10 bucks and you get these two other 7 inches, these newer bands, you know. And it was a great way, you know, and it kind of made its own little ecosystem, because I used to do that fest every year that like people would come all over the world for. And like Left 4 Dead had played, you know, we did Left 4 Dead, Despise You, Lack of Interest that one time. And Integrity played with the Melnicks one time.
Yeah, that's the one I can't believe I never got to see. That's like the one, man. That's just like, because that's like, you know, like, and that is like the like Fleetwood Mac, they're never getting back together of hardcore.
Aaron's been playing with them. I don't know if you've seen.
Well, now it's different, but like, I mean, like up until that point, it felt like that was just something that would never happen.
Absolutely. It took a lot of cajoling, and it eventually imploded right after, because like, you know, Integrity's already had like a good like decade plus of just Dwid steering the ship. So it's like, yeah, the history is important, but he didn't need the history to keep the band going. He already had the band doing new records, and things were happening with like Suicide Black Snake and Blackest Curse. And then eventually Howling, where it's like, you know, Dwid had made it its own fucking animal. So, you know, bringing Aaron back and stuff is a treat, because it's like, you know, it's the original architect for the old fans and for the new fans. But it's also like, you know, Dwid's created a situation where the band can keep going at any costs. And like, you know, he'll be able to keep doing it for as long as he wants to. And I think that's magic. But yeah, that show was unreal. It was like easy top five of all time.
They're really like, they're, you know, and obviously they've done covers and stuff, but like they're weirdly like almost like a 90s Misfits in a way.
Yeah, I think a lot of Integrity's aesthetic borrows from like Danzig and Danzig related things right down to the skull, you know.
But I mean, and even like go on.
No, just the way he runs the band, it's just like, you know, it's very specific. That's the best way to put it. He's a very specific dude.
Yeah, and how it's like it's almost this band that's at one time the greatest hardcore band ever, and another time not at all a hardcore band, in the same way the Misfits are the greatest punk band of all time, and at the same time not at all a punk band.
Sure. Yeah. I think the trajectories kind of line up. You kind of put them together, you know?
I guess like Trapped Under Ice too, that's 7-inch is like,
I did a 7-inch split. Yeah.
Yeah.
I split with Dirty Money.
Yeah. Both those bands. Sorry, go on.
They used to live next door to me. Yeah, Justice lived in the house next door to me, and their demo was awesome. Everyone loved that demo when it came out, you know what I mean? And they were starting out, and the dudes were rolling up, but like, you know, they would show up without a bass player or just whatever and just play anyway. And I'm like, your songs are really good. You're not doing these songs justice by like, you know, regroup, you know, get that shit together. And fucking then they fucking did, and it took over the world, you know what I mean? It was like huge. And like that, me being the small part with that 7-inch was big deal. Those are two of my favorite songs they did. But I saw him at the airport the other day. Me and my wife were in London. We went to go see Susie play at the Troxy a couple weeks ago, and Angel Dust was on the same flight, which was totally ridiculous, right? I'm just like, but
it's interesting though, with like Dirty Money being like pre High Viz and Turnstile kind of being, you know, the precursor to, or to the post, whatever, I guess, same time as Trapped Under Ice, but it's another two bands that have both gone on to have, like, I think High Viz is blowing up. I think it's just the beginning for that band too.
People love them. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really connected. And so it's interesting how, you know, there's another large part of this culture that starts off on the label in a way.
In a weird way, it's kind of touched a lot of things. I think you could trace most things back to, you know, not patting myself on the back, but I think I managed to get my DNA on a lot of different things, where it's just like, even if it's like a small spec, you can be like, oh, fuck, you know, they played that show or did something. I always, and I take pride in that, not because for any other reason that like it proves that good music fucking deserves to be out there and enjoyed, you know what I mean? And that like I was right, despite even if it's like that big and being like, you should listen to this band, even if it's just telling one person, you know what I mean? And seeing that band still around now kicking ass, that makes me feel good. That makes me feel like, you know, I think there's a lot, a lot of music that doesn't stand the test of time, that kind of like just I listen to it and it's kind of flaccid and it doesn't really do much for me. So when it's like something that's really good and earnest and like really fucking hits, I like seeing it go the distance, and seeing all those dudes go the distance is like been amazing.
If you were to tell me that all these years later, Back to Basics catalog minus the Fat Nut 7-inch was going the distance, I would have laughed you out of full blast.
I told you, dude. People worshiping Bulldoze is fucking blowing my mind. I'm all about it. Bulldoze is fucking rules. The Blood Rot 7-inch was my shit. I'm fucking on Black to on Back to Basics. It was like this. They were called New Jersey Devil Core, which falls in line with that Bloodlet description about spilling blood. And I was like, this record's great, you know? And
Yeah, that is man, this has been awesome, dude. And anytime you want to come back on this thing and talk about any of this stuff, because we barely like we didn't even talk pulling teeth.
yeah,
You know the
perfect.
door's always open.
Sure, anytime, Damien. It's a pleasure. It's great seeing you too. It's been a long time. I still remember, like I said, that one conversation where we talked about the Biohazard demo when we first met. We're just like.
Thank you, Dom, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, he will be back for a part two at some point in the future. Because there's lots of stuff we didn't get a chance to talk about on this one. And so we will be diving into that. Maybe a splits with him and Jordan from Terror would be awesome. I'm booking the show in my head right now. Anyway, on to the next episode. On the next episode of this show, an amazing one with a member of the bands No Use for a Name, Rat Pack, and the Foo Fighters, Chris Shiflett will be on the show, and I am very excited for you to hear this one. A fun conversation with a guy I've been on tour, a road dog, a fellow road dog, and some interesting perspective on his career. You'll hear that all on the next episode. Well, that is it for me. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues of Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect their selves, their rights, their freedoms, and stop hate and violence towards people of different faiths and different races and different nationalities, because this isn't politics. This is basic human rights shit. People deserve to be able to live free from hatred and discrimination. And if there's organizations in your community that are affecting positive change and you want to get involved, I'm sure they could benefit from your time or your money if you can spare it. It'll affect your mental health as well. Speaking about affecting your mental health, try meditating. I know a lot of people talk about this all the time, and I didn't really believe in it. And then I tried it, and now it kind of works for me if I remember to do it. So maybe it will for you. Speaking of things that work, I have seen miracles happen because of organ donation and organ transplants. So sign your organ donor cards, because you don't need those organs when they come and look for them. They're literally dead weight. And get involved in punk. Start a band, start a fanzine, start a podcast. Not a podcast, but start anything. Anyone can do this shit. And who knows, years later, you could be still involved doing bands, running labels. Who knows? Who knows? One thing I do know is that's the end of today's show. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Stay safe. Bye.